Group's Summer School, Saturday afternoon, 19th June, 1982. The question here is, if, as you say, elderly people have degenerated into vegetables, would you advise supporting euthanasia? It's a very important question which is exercising the minds of many people quite seriously. And there are, of course, arguments for and against it. One of the difficulties could arise this way. If euthanasia is going to be allowed in society, it is perhaps possible for a man, I say a man, I mean any human being, man or woman, who murders somebody to bring evidence that that person took to euthanasia. But of course, you know the good old saying, murder will out. Somehow or other, he's found out. But I don't know whether in modern times there are murderers who have never been found out. You see, of course, in this era of so much violence, callous, cold-blooded, premeditated murder. We have many examples of that not so very far from here. And we know of examples in many of the continents, several of the continents of the world. The murderer cannot be found out. But if somebody uses that as an argument and actually he has committed a murder and it was not a case of the sufferer himself or herself taking his or her own life, then that is one of the difficulties if society allows euthanasia. But it seems to me that if people have become very old, they have lost their faculties, their minds are just cabbages, so to say, then it seems that it would be merciful to allow them euthanasia, recourse to euthanasia. We are responsible for our own lives after we are born. Not immediately after, of course. But in due time, when we grow to adulthood, we are responsible for our own lives. And if one takes one's own life as a retreat from society, a retreat from the difficulties of life, then it is surely a mistake. That sort of suicide is a mistake. There are occasions when even when one is in one's younger years, one suffers so much illness or whatever it is, that life becomes utterly impossible. And if it is a case of unbearable pain physically, certainly, and possibly also psychically. Perhaps euthanasia might be regarded as allowable. But in the case of people who become, who are in their 70s, late 70s, 80s, 90s, who are quite, well, as the question says, degenerated into vegetables. No insult to vegetables intended, I trust here. Who have really lost their faculties and wish that they were dead altogether, you see. That it's too much for them to bear. It seems to me that euthanasia should be permitted. Perhaps they can have safeguards having some sort of medical consent in the matter. Maybe a panel of doctors or something like that. I don't know what you feel about it. Don't think that I've got to do all the talking. You can talk generally today, since you have not asked other questions, except one more. What do you feel about it? Anybody?
I think it is generally accepted within the medical profession that when children who are very sadly lacking in their proper faculties and so on, it's believed that it's not worthwhile them living anymore, the treatment is withdrawn. I think this is a very well accepted thing. And when this was talked about on the television recently, no one had the courage to say so when one man came under attack over it. And everybody argued around the point. But someone did say to me that it is done, and it is done often. In the case that these were spastic children we were talking about then. So perhaps without breaking the law, the best of both worlds is around it sometimes. That obviously.
And there was a case recently when the child was allowed to die. You remember? It came out on TV too. The child was allowed to die.
Wasn't that the doctor had up for murder, wasn't he?
Yes, but
he, had a charge, wasn't he?
He was acquitted.
Yes,
you see. It's a very difficult question.
The medical profession have two methods of dealing with this, you know. One is NR by the side of the bed in the hospital.
What does that mean?
No resuscitation.
Ah.
In other words, let the person peacefully pass on. And in a case of acute advanced cancer, they often, the trouble with the patient is that the pain is rising constantly, and then the morphine to catch up, you see, and then the pain and the morphine, the pain and the morphine, and the morphine gets greater than the pain. And I understand that there's something applied, what they call the Brompton cocktail, which is the finish. That's medically. But that's, I think, a bit entrepreneur between doctors who wink at each other and say there's nothing but this poor thing has to suffer the pain.
Perhaps one might institute something like this, that if the patient himself or herself really requests that he or she be allowed to die, then doctors can do the needful, should be allowed to do the needful, if in their judgment also this person, for this person to continue living would be something too terrible to endure. Of course, if a person himself has a different view of life and feels that whatever happens in terms of pain and sorrow and whatnot, it is necessary that he should continue to live and try to understand if there is that sort of spiritual urge from within himself, then even though he suffers so much, let him live. Because any person's effort to understand the whole problem of sorrow and pain, that effort has an influence upon his surroundings. There is a psychical influence always. The act of thinking, of speaking, influences the psychical atmosphere. And it may be that if he's capable of seeing things in a profound way, then that is, he is doing good to his fellow human beings without his knowing it, so to say. But I dare say that sort of situation is extremely rare. Very few people who are willing to have that attitude towards pain, sheer physical pain and grief. So much depends on how we are brought up right from the beginning. That, I think, is one of our great troubles in life. From the very beginning, the little child grows up in the atmosphere of enjoyment. Let us enjoy life. Let us be happy. Let us have fun. Let us have pleasure. And so forth and so forth. And so the whole outlook on life is a warped outlook. Right from childhood, people don't realize that there is a purpose in our individual human existence. And it is only in so far as that purpose is understood, even in a limited degree, and thereafter we attempt to live by standards and behavior in harmony with that purpose, then life is worth living. And then only do we really grow towards our true humanity. Sometimes that purpose of existence is presented to some children. The parents do their best along that line. Maybe the priest, the school teacher could help. If it is not a presentation which conditions the child too powerfully, makes him a fanatic or something like that, then it is helpful. But we haven't got that. We have this wonderful song about Britons never, never, never shall be slaves. But not only Britons, but the whole world is in abject slavery to its animal drives. There is no getting away from that fact. We are the slaves of our pleasure drive and the drive to be somebody, which always means at the expense of the other body. Hence competition arises. If it just stops at ordinary playful competition, football matches and the like, alright, no serious harm is done, although even that nowadays produces a great deal of trouble, as we know, you see. But when this competition becomes a national affair, between nations, and all sorts of international difficulties arise, then we get wars and so forth. Wars may be a useful way occasionally for keeping the population down, the world population, and prevent the population explosion up to a point. But it's a most horrible way, really, and especially modern war. Well, you have all, I'm sure, seen the TV pictures of the British soldiers who have come back from the Falkland Islands when their ship was hit by these Exocet missiles. It's a terrible thing that man can do that and will do that. And we are the people who claim to be the advanced nations of the world. Advanced in what? In stupidity, cruelty, wickedness, lust for possessions, power, and all the rest of it. And we claim to be the educated people of the world. And we make it our mission sometimes to go abroad and convert the heathen and give him some sort of education and so forth. These were sort of very noble sounding ideals, particularly in the early, late 18th and the early 19th century. For example, just to take one example out of many, in 1828, I believe, when Lord William Bentinck was Governor General there in India, he got the authorities to vote for £10,000 to be devoted to the education of the Indian people. In what? English history, English political ideals, Christianity, and so on and so on, you see. It is to the credit of the British people that years later, George Nathaniel Curzon, that very superior person, you see, criticized this educational system which was introduced into India. And he also foresaw that this very educational system by which people in India were brought up on the English language, English literature, and everything English, and were conditioned to believe that that whatever England stood for was the supreme thing in the world, were the very people who ultimately founded the Indian National Congress, and in 1947 the British Raj departed. You see, it's extraordinary. We have to be very careful about our ideals. We think this is a good thing, the right thing. But we are unable to have, we do not have sufficient vision to see the possible, perhaps probable consequences in the future. In so many respects, great good was done by the whole series of governors general and the viceroys who followed them after 1856. Great good was done, and India reaps the benefit of that to this day. Slowly India is acknowledging those things. I think I was one of the first speakers in this country when I was sent round by the Ministry of Information and later on the Central Office of Information to lecture all over this country on India, Indian culture and so forth, and the British connection with India. I think I was one of the first to point out all the essential good that Britain did in India and which India is now enjoying the benefits of. Particularly, for instance, the administration of justice. The British system of administration of justice is probably the most advanced in the modern world and fair. Also, materially, connecting up all India by roads and railways and so forth, and doing so many things to counter the ravages of famine, disease, and all those things. Those were the good things. So I'm not suggesting that it is always wrong or that in those cases where one nation does good according to its own views to another nation, it is always to the benefit of the ruling power. You see? It is altruistic on the one hand, and it is also lacking in vision in some respects, on the other hand. Because in the early years, when the first governors general were there, particularly Lord Cornwallis in the 1790s, laws were passed in England through his initiation, which prevented anyone from England going to India and setting up machinery. That absolutely destroyed the textile trade of India. And all the wonderful textiles that they manufactured went by the board. And in several other respects like that, there were mistakes made. But then, we are all human. Even I make mistakes, you know. So, going back to euthanasia.
There's a great difference between withdrawing life support and treatment that keeps life going and actually administering euthanasia, isn't that?
But I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
There's a great difference between withdrawing life support and actually administering euthanasia.
Yes, there is. Well, it brings the same result.
Yes, but I think it's very difficult. I mean, I've worked quite a lot with geriatric patients and with mentally handicapped children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very difficult question.
It is.
Because I've seen some geriatric patients, not vegetables, but one might have thought, my goodness, they wish to die. If you see them in some hospital ward with nothing much being done for them. But if you, in my case, sort of give them a paintbrush or have them, you'd be amazed at what they do. I mean, a lot depends on the attitude of people around them and what they think is possible sometimes.
Mm.
And the same with... mentally handicapped children. I mean, a lot of it's degree, but who is going to... I think it's often very individual, and really that it's something that can't be legislated about, but it just depends on the moment those with handicapped children and...
Because if you legislated it, I can
see a great many. You know, it might be very legalize a lot of them.
Undesirable things.
Yes.
Yes.
Attitudes and enclosed attitudes as to when it was.
May I draw attention to something here? Two things. There will always be misuse of something, irrespective of what it is, because of the nature of the majority of human beings. Euthanasia is something that should be gone into when the person concerned, and I agree wholeheartedly, is absolutely an individual thing. It can never be a mass thing. But when that person is in full command of their faculties, that becomes something for consideration. And I feel that this links up very closely with Ferozzi's talk on death. It's useless when obviously somebody is in a state of senility to be in extremis, so that they couldn't possibly consider anything at all. That was all I wished to draw attention to. There are circumstances where it is possible to draw attention to your wishes when you are still, as I say, in full command of your faculties, which your medical doctor will, if he is in sympathy with you or rapport with you, will certainly be of great assistance. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, any other questions?
Yes.
two or more people come together and they talk about realities seriously and with attention, nearly always at the end, all the people or just the two people find they have more energy. Now, where does that energy come from?
There are so many layers of the mind. Don't think of the layers as if they were a pile of books, one on top of the other. So many, or shall I put it this way, there are so many intensities of attentiveness by the mind. Now, when one deals with something which is of real importance from the life point of view, you see, of real importance, then it calls out hidden, latent energies within the whole being, the psychophysical being. And as they proceed with their investigation, so to say, by exchanging views, ideas, and so forth, there is this energy which they draw upon, which normally they cannot draw upon just by themselves. That is why that's a great help. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so. And it seems to me so mysterious.
Yes, there are. It is extraordinary what depths there are within the psyche. Tremendous depths. And they are sources of great energy and great power, psychical energy. So that if one touches that in the deeps of consciousness, then it energizes the whole psychophysical organism. See? That is how it happens. Mind you, age has something to do with it also. When one passes a certain age, which is probably special to that individual, this phenomenon doesn't take place because the organism is too much on the departing platform rather than the arriving platform. You see? And therefore, no benefit results. But as long as one is healthy in the full sense of the word, one is always energized if the discussion or whatever it is takes place along the right lines. There is always energy which is drawn upon.
Is there another thing, Firoz? There's been a program on the television about the human brain.
Yes.
And the it's too complicated. I can't possibly explain exactly what I'm thinking of. Mm. But the fact of discussion, that causes adrenaline, doesn't it? And that it causes the brain...
Makes the flow, brings about the flow of adrenaline, yes.
And then gives you energy from that source.
Yes. Yes. Anger also will do it.
Yes.
You see?
Yes.
The question is whether it is the sort of adrenaline which polishes you off, or, shall we say, polishes you up.
Wasn't the one that you're referring to in the one on the fear?
Yes, that
was adrenaline talked about so much in that. Where does fear come from? In what part of the brain is fear
engendered, or where does it come from? It's fascinating.
Was it a BBC talk?
Yes, yes. Yes. Yes, indeed. Would you think the majority of people, I mean, would not be at all interested?
That is quite true.
Well, I wonder why that is.
They are constituted that way. You see, take for instance the fact that the world produces just a few geniuses. An occasional genius here, there, or wherever it is. But the bulk of us are what we call ordinary folk. And some are extraordinary the wrong way. So that's how the world is at its present stage of development. After all, we've been only 3 or 4 million years on the globe. You see, and during that period, considerable changes have taken place structurally, physically, and with the brain too, and so forth. And here we are at present, as we are. And if we don't misbehave to the extent of destroying ourselves altogether, it will take a few million years yet before we are really adult humans. You know the meaning of the word human. Consists of hu, which is the prefix, which is equivalent to su, and man, which is the Sanskrit root of the word mind, you see. And su or hu means happy, you see. And mind in this context is not just a person's brain capacity. It's something much deeper and much greater than that. It is the creative, formative agency throughout the universal process. Mind in its profundity, you see. So the human being really means the happy creator. That's just what we say of God, don't we? Shall I put it this way? God is very happy when we do right.
Ah, yes.
When we do wrong and suffer for our stupidity, God is equally happy. He enjoys himself. He enjoys himself saying, serve those people right. Why don't they live as they ought to live? Pardon?
People are constituted, but only each person seems to have his own constitution,
yes.
Which he can't, a sort of blueprint, which he can either fulfill or he can't. But he can't go beyond that.
That is true. So?
Well, a person is born, let's say, with very bad faults. And you can't blame the person, and you do, I mean, one does. But you can't, in fact, blame him for having these things which could be considered faults.
No, there's no question of blame involved in it. That is how it is, you see. And that person behaves like that and enjoys or suffers life in his particular way and spreads either happiness or suffering to others. Because no one is entirely alone. Even a hermit who lives in a cave and is not visited by anybody at all, even he is affecting society all the time by his very existence and presence, because there is the effect of our feelings and thoughts which spread out all the time. Each feeling or thought perhaps may be compared to a stone dropped in a pond, and the ripples go out to the edge of the pond. So you see, even if a person lives entirely by himself, he's affecting life all the time. By the very fact of his existence.
Mm.